Hello, everyone, and welcome to a special Christmas episode of Note to Scene, a music news podcast covering everything from pop punk to metalcore. I'm Matt Crane.
I'm Tyler Sharp.
And welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. Find more episodes of this show on Apple Podcasts, where you should please rate and review us. Email us at notescene@gmail.com. This week, we are doing something special. 2017 was a terrible year for music. And in honor of that, we will be counting down the worst scene albums of the year. These are all the bands that deserve coal in their stockings. Happy holidays, everyone. Let's go. Merry Christmas, Tyler Sharp.
Merry Christmas, Matt. How you doing, man?
Dude, I'm doing good. It's the holiday season. I'm chilling with some eggnog. How about you?
Dude, I don't know how you eat that shit, man. That's the fucking worst. Got some hot
Of
chocolate
course.
by me, wearing a Santa hat. I'm ready, man.
There you
I love
go,
the
man.
holidays.
I got
love
the
the
candy
holidays.
cane scarf wrapped around my neck.
Nice.
There we go.
Nice. True note to
But
scene Christmas.
absolutely. But so, all right, I got to ask you, what's going on with my man Burt McCracken in this used interview with the gun show? Like, did my man just fire a shot across the bow of MCR? Like, what's going on here? Explain this.
I think he's throwing some shade at Gerard Way, man. So the Guns asked him a question.
Shouts to the Guns. Good guy.
Right. Always been around, always hustling. Ask Bert a question. What do you think you'll see first? Donald Trump get impeached or a My Chemical Romance reunion? And Bert responded with, there's only one of those I would like to see happen. And I think there is some mad shade being thrown
there at
2017. He looks
at the camera. Like, he looks at the camera like he gives it like a pretty handsome, awkward look. You know what I mean? Like, it's just devilish in his face. Like, Bert, what are you doing, man? Like, are you crazy? Like,
right? It's the holidays, man.
Yeah, and he just, like, this is a wound he just tore open, you know, this MCR used rift that hasn't even been addressed in, like, I don't know, 15 years.
Right?
And,
it's been at least a decade.
It's funny. It's like, is that what the used have left? It's almost like, would that be a smart career choice for them now to start beefing with MCR again? Beefing with a band that's broken up? You know, like, what are you doing, fam?
I have no idea, man.
Oh,
I think this is like a last-ditch effort at this point.
I just could the smile I saw on Bert's face when he
it
said
was
that.
Sinister,
like, he just,
man.
It's just the first time we've heard him attack, you know, MCR and Gerard in a long, long, long time. Like,
right?
We thought that was long buried, and he has not forgotten.
Right. Shouts to our boy Jeremy for the tip on this one. I would have never caught this, but he asked me if I saw it, and I was like, no, dude, send that shit, man. So.
If it's GWA related, Jeremy's not going to miss it.
Right.
But all right, let's get into our listener questions for this week. Our first question comes in from longtime listener Aaron L., who writes into notescene@gmail.com. Aaron asks, what's your favorite scene Christmas song? So for me, it's tough to narrow it down because I like a lot of them. Blink-182, I Won't Be Home for Christmas, is one I've always loved. Sonically, my favorite is probably Fall Out Boy, You'll Shoot
Ooh,
Your Eyes Out.
That's a classic.
Yeah, it's just so good. You kind of got to acknowledge Jimmy Eat World's Last Christmas. It's kind of considered a classic at this time as a cover. And so I give that one acknowledgement. I really love The Killers, Joel, The Lump of Coal. I'm a big fan of that one. Gotta give shouts to the boy Andrew, SoCo, Forget December. Like, I gotta give those shouts.
Nice.
And of course, like, MCR doing All I Want for Christmas and The Used alone this holiday are just, they're just classics at this point as far as seeing Christmas songs go, and they kind of have to be acknowledged in that way and revered. But for me, my favorite scene Christmas song is not a Christmas song at all. It's actually just My Chemical Romance's Welcome to the Black Parade. To me, that is a Christmas song. I don't know what it is. I just
have
so many memories of that song coming on during Christmas, driving in the car through snow and Christmas lights with my friends, us just blaring that song. I have a specific memory
that
of
is
me and
so
my friend.
Funny.
Yeah, me and my friend, she had like, I don't know, recently got her permit or something, and we were driving in like her dad's SUV, and she was driving, and we were driving through like this little downtown area where everyone was shopping, and you know, it's freezing cold, it's snow, it's Christmas, and we put all the windows down and just blasted that song at full blast just to piss everyone off, and drove down the street just like laughing and loving it. So now it's like every now and then when that song comes on, like in the winter on radio rotation, which is rare, but like it still does, I just crank it every time. And it gives me fond memories of Christmas. How about you, T-Sharp? What is your favorite scene Christmas song?
That's so funny. So I'm a little bit more off the scene reservoir than you are, but in true tooth and nail and solid state fashion, one of my favorites, I would absolutely put my top five, would be I Celebrate the Day, which is off Reliant K's Christmas album, Let It Snow, Baby, Let It Reindeer. I bought this album when I was in middle school, and it's just a seasonal mainstay for me every single year.
I've been seeing a lot of Reliant K Christmas on Spotify, all over the place.
This album is, if you listen to this album when it came out in 2007, it's a classic for you. And this song is total, like, drive-through emo. It's so good with a little bit of piano rock in it, but it's an absolute emo song. I love it. Another random one would be Christmas at 22 by the Wonder Years. Thematically, it's just Soupy talking about how all his friends are home from college and it's Christmas Eve, and just spending this time with your friends and people you love, and throwing a frozen pizza in and watching Christmas classics and driving all your drunken friends home.
That is Soupy's role, is to capture those moments of your life and put them into musical context. And that is just what the guy does.
That song just does it perfect for me. So yeah, Wonder Years and Reliant K for me. I went off the reservoir a bit, but great question. I love talking about this shit. Yeah.
Our next question comes in from listener Anthony D. Anthony says, so, guys, with the year 2017 coming to a close, which without a doubt has been a rough year for the scene, what was your album of the year and your single of the year? So, Tyler and I, we don't do this a lot as far as recommendations go. Like, we analyze and we critique things and we sort of give our overall thoughts, but we don't often, like, say, this is our favorite, you should listen to this, or you know what I mean? So this is kind of a chance for us to say, like, this is our favorite album and this is our favorite song. So I'm going to do that now. My favorite single of the year was SGL by the band Now Now. If you haven't heard them, it's a kind of like an emo meets indie rock thing with a girl with one of the most gorgeous voices I've ever heard. It's such an amazing song. Go listen to this song right now. It's my song of the year. My album of the year is Lorde Melodrama. No surprise to longtime listeners. I am a huge Lorde fan. And this is just my favorite album of the year. I think it's fucking beautiful. And you should go listen to it. You are doing yourself a disservice if you do not. How about you, T-Sharp? Single of the year and album of the year.
So my single of the year is The Bright Side by Lil Peep. You know, if you were listening to this song when it came, if you were listening to the show when this song came out, you know how much I loved it. Matt loved it. This song was going to change everything.
I am pouring out my Coke Zero right now, man.
Dude, it was going to change everything. And like, if you go back and watch live videos of him performing this song, there's one in particular where it's the very end of the first verse and it's right before the chorus drops. And when that chorus drops, he doesn't even have to say anything. The audience is just screaming it back and you can barely hear the music. It sounds like he's leading a fucking revolution when he'd play this song live. And sonically, it's just, it was the future. And just taken from us too soon. So
interesting you chose that over
awful things.
Awful things. Yeah. Interesting that you chose, because I thought that was your favorite one.
Yeah. It was definitely a tough one. It was a toss up between those two. But Bright Side, me and my buddy drove around all night recently. We're both on Christmas break right now and we just listened to Lil Peep songs, and in that moment it hit me that Bright Side was a better song than Awful Things.
Very,
but I still love
very
both.
Special song.
Yeah,
special
definitely.
Song. Album, Tyler?
Album, for me, is one that I've never been able to talk about on the show this year, and I'm so glad I have the opportunity to. It's by a band called Sufferer, and the album's called Sufferer. Suffer is a low-key supergroup with members of Eye the Mighty, A Lot Like Birds, and Hail the Sun. And this album, if you loved anything about 2004 to 2006, as far as like the emo post-hardcore movement, you will love this album. It is everything that was so great about the aggression, the emotion, the production value of that music. It's dark as hell. And if you liked anything from Under Oath to Emery to any Tooth and Nail band, pretty much, you'll love this album. I highly recommend it to anyone who wants to take a look back at Screamo's mainstream peak. It's a great album, and I definitely recommend it.
Definitely a fresh sound. We thank Anthony and Aaron for writing into netscene@gmail.com. If you have any questions for the show, feel free to send them that way. And sorry to everyone who sent a question that wasn't answered in 2017. We will be doing our best to knock those out in 2018. Might have to do an all listener question mailbag episode.
Dude,
at some point.
I think so, man.
That might be a fun idea. All right, a couple quick news items to hit before we get going with the show. So Pierce the Veil announced that drummer Mike Fuentes is taking a break and stepping away from the band. This is following all of the allegations that have been swirling around him on the internet that we've been dealing with. And it's kind of interesting because Pierce had kind of gone into sort of like lockdown hibernation mode, and we hadn't heard from them for a long time. It seemed like they were just going to kind of wait this out. And then the Melmar thing blew up, mm-hmm. and it was like everybody just forgot about Pierce. And now here they are back with this big statement from Mike.
Yeah, it really looked like they were going to pull a Story So Far. You know, the Story So Far, mm-hmm. after Parker kicked that girl off the stage and the entire world revolted against his actions, which rightfully so, but they just didn't say anything for 3 weeks, and then they played Warped Tour and were direct support for Good Charlotte in the fall, and now everyone forgot about it. Like, that didn't even happen as far as history is concerned. But here we are. Pierce the Veil dropped a statement, and without getting too much into it, because I hate talking about this, and I just don't. It's a hard thing.
You don't want to get me sued. Matt's been threatened to be sued by musicians, and right. He does not like it.
It's a hard thing to talk about, but at the same rate, I think it's important to acknowledge news on the show, like I've said before, because I think some of our listeners actually do use it as a news source. So for the time being, Mike Fuentes is, quote, taking a break from Pierce the Veil. What that means, we don't know. Pierce the Veil canceled their UK tour with All Time Low. This band will be back, and from the sound of it, Mike Fuentes will be back in this band at some point down the line.
But yeah. That's, and here's my thing. We may not know, but I think I know. Like,
okay.
I know this band, and I know their management, and their manager is like their mother.
Mm-hmm.
She's never going to turn her back on Mike, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing what I know of this band, I don't think it was ever even a question of Mike being kicked out of the band. Notice, he's taking a break. He's
right.
Stepping away. He's not out of the band. I imagine in their camp, it was never even a question of him leaving. I think their manager is going to protect him. And even if it was a question of him leaving, Vic, his brother, would not go for it. Knowing what I know of that, those brothers in that band, if it would have come down to that, it would have came down to Vic being like, okay, I'm out too. Have fun without your front man. You know what I mean? So I think that's kind of the political landscape Pierce are in at the moment. And, you know, I'm not taking sides on anything or agreeing on anything. I'm just sort of trying to outline what I believe is their state.
You're right. They're brothers.
The brotherhood bond between those two, it's just not going to be broken. And Vic's going to stand by him. And I don't even think it got to that far. I think, you know,
yeah.
I think the plan here is clearly protect Mike. That's what the band are doing.
Right.
And whether you think that's right or wrong, we're not commenting on that. I'm not saying my opinion on that. I'm just saying what I see in the optics of the situation.
For sure. I mean, if you go out and read this statement, media outlets should have ran the headline as like, Pierce the Veil don't actually do anything about sexual
right.
assault allegations.
No, nothing changes whatsoever. Okay,
right.
But let's move on to our only other news story this week. Much feel better story.
Yeah, so it's 180.
Panic the Disco released a Christmas song, Feels Like Christmas, Tyler. And I gotta say, dude, hell yeah. Like,
right?
Brendan Urie.
Right?
This is my guy.
Yeah.
That voice. Like, holiday cheer, dude. Like, this is how it's done. Just like, I don't even care how much I like the song. It's just great to hear fucking Brendan's voice during the holidays. Just fucking Brendan Urieing it up. Like, this song makes me want to, like, get drunk and fall into the Christmas tree and knock over a bunch of ornaments. You know what I mean? It's
right.
just fun, you know?
Right. It's a total, it's a classic new wave panic song. It's got your jukeboxy vibes, but then it's got Brendan's, like, new wave sheen over it. It's just, it's classic panic in a Christmas
Dog's got,
lens.
Like, a holiday voice. Like, he could do a cover of, like, I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas. You know what I mean? He could totally do that. Like,
Totally. Dude, do you remember when we were both at AP and Fall Out Boy dropped the Brendan Urie's Drunk History of Fall Out Boy video on Christmas
yep.
Day? And you sent
Classic
it to me, and I ran it on Christmas Day.
Yes.
The good old days.
Getting those clicks on Christmas Day.
The
Love
good old
it.
Days.
Definitely way better than Sleeping with Sirens' Christmas on the Road Christmas song.
They released a Christmas song? Says
remember
every
Christmas
listener.
On the Road? Yeah.
Says, listen,
yeah.
says everyone.
We talked
ever.
About it on this show.
Oh,
listeners.
I know, but no
y'all
one is
going
to remember that song.
Yeah. It's just like the only other one I can think of that a prominent band did this year. And I would say Panic washed them.
Oh, it's not even close. Shout out to Warner Brothers.
Okay. All right. So let's get into the main topic here. And I want to start by saying, look, like, we didn't want to do this. Like, Tyler and I, in a perfect world, we want to be here with you ranking the 10 best scene albums of the year. But it's just, you know, we got together and we talked. We just couldn't do it. There just weren't enough or any good albums of a prominent nature to put together into a good list that, you know, our listeners would give a shit about. Like, all of Tyler's best albums, you wouldn't care about because you've never heard of them. All of my best albums are pop albums, you know, you wouldn't give a shit about them. And so there was just so much bad stuff that came out in the scene this year. And so that's why we're doing this, because we have to, you know. I hope in 2018, instead of highlighting, you know, the worst scene albums, I hope we can highlight the best. We'll just see what 2018 has to bring to us.
2018 is the scene's last stand, man.
A day to remember, you know, bring me, you know, there's a lot of stuff on the horizon.
Panic, and, 21 Pilots.
Yeah, I hope we can be doing a best of, but 2017 was an undeniably shitty year for scene music. So we're going to count down the five worst scene albums. Before we do that, though, Tyler, I kind of want to talk about just some of our disappointments this year. Like, these aren't bad albums, right? These are just albums that I think we were let down by. You can kind of start with Paris. Would you agree Paris was a disappointment this year?
I really tried to like that album. And in hindsight, revisiting that album at the end of the year, I can't. I cannot like it. Those songs are just bad. Where are the choruses, man? Where are those white noise moments? They're just gone into this gritty, grungy void that Pitchfork just gets off on. It's so sad. It's sad.
Yeah, coming from probably the most promising band of the year too. Ugh. Like, this was supposed to be their year and their moment, and what do we end up with? 10,000 copies first week.
Forgettable album.
You know why they sold 10,000 copies first week? Because, like you said, it wasn't anything near the caliber of White Noise. You know, they're doing this tribal freaking jungle cave goth rock indie rock thing, and I was just like listening to anyone else today, and I was just like, what the fuck, man? Like, what are you doing? But I gotta say, it's not a bad album. It, you know, as a rock album from an anonymous band, I think it's okay. Like, it's a decent, like, I like Nola and I like, you know, Heaven, and I like some other songs. It's a good, it's a competent record, you know. It was just disappointing. It's not, you know, we wanted Paris to put out the best record of the year, frankly. Like, I think this should have been the band to do it. And the disappointment was heavy.
It's a 10K first week album. That's what it is. Exactly. They did exactly what they should have done with this type of music. And I think as we get through this episode, I think it's quite obvious it's time to stop backing Blake Harnage as a songwriter.
Yeah. And where we, you know, had Paris release not White Noise Part 2 conceptually, but White Noise Part 2 successfully as of, like, you know, just capturing that kind of energy, we'd have seen like a 27,000 copies.
Absolutely. Over 25.
But they didn't do
that
yet. You know what I mean? What's one for you that was a disappointment, Tyler?
One for me was definitely Turnover. And I know it's in the indie world, but that band was having such a moment after Peripheral Vision. And we didn't really ever talk about this band on the show at all. But that last album just gave them so much hype. And it was emo. It wasn't just indie. It had a scene emo vibe to it. And they fucking blew it on this new album. It's a total pile of dog shit. I was so disappointed by it, and everyone was. I mean, I think it did like 7,800 first week, but and that was only because of the hype off right. of Peripheral Vision, and it was just it
very
was just a major
good
disappointment.
First week for a band like that. And yeah, I gotta say, you know, just very how fast they became the It band was just sort of fascinating to see. You know, based off that first album, they went from opening for no one for a no one band to just being like the It band of the moment. You know, they kind of followed like
there was Citizen, Title Fight.
They followed like Title Fight and Citizen and Hotelier and all those bands. They followed them into the itness of the emo revival. You know what I mean? And they were just like the It band, but didn't work out for them, like you said. So another one that was disappointing for me was Neck Deep. And this is an interesting one. I got to ask, like, are we wrong, Tyler? Because I think we're both disappointed by this. But, you know, the album sold 30,000 copies first week. And I don't know that we're right. Like, are we on the wrong side of history here? But, like, I was definitely disappointed by this record.
I think the general consensus was that it was disappointing and it didn't live up to the hype of a post Life's Not Out to Get You world. Remember, good. It did 29,000 first week because they had pre-orders at their merch table on Warped Tour all summer long. And there was only two songs out at that point. And the people were blindly supporting this band because they released a fantastic album beforehand.
Yeah. And they had hype from the first album, and they had a unique opportunity on Warped Tour to sort of be the biggest band, you know, which is a weird thing, like why they got to do that. Oof. But that's a whole other conversation.
Right.
It's just a basic pop punk album. You know, I don't hate it. I can enjoy it.
There's certainly tolerable songs. You know, we talked about them on the show.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it's like a 6.5 out of 10. It's just, sure. There's nothing special there. There's no magic. Paramore. We got to talk about Paramore. Where are you at with Paramore, Tyler?
Still a huge disappointment for me. And we were so excited about this band. We literally, when that first single dropped, we named the episode "The Paramore Party Starts Now." And if you go back and look at our episodes after that, it was like the Paramore album just flopped. It was like two episodes later, because there was like a month lead up. But it was so sad, man. I still don't Hard Times. I think Fake Happy is a terrible fucking song. They blew it here. They had an opportunity to be a massive pop band, and instead they wanted to be Pitchfork fodder. And now, sure, they'll play Lollapalooza every year, but people are going to start forgetting about this band unless they do an about turn and ditch this. But from what I've heard behind the scenes, that's not going to happen.
No, not going to happen. Yeah, I have a very complicated relationship with this album because, first off, Hard Times is one of my songs of the year. You know, I loved that song. Crazy. I was so hyped. And the album that followed just did not live up to that for me. And I don't hate the album again. If this came from some other cool, you know, female-fronted indie rock band, I think I would, like it more. But it's the fact that I got it from Paramore that was so disappointing. Like, there are songs like Rose Colored Boy, Caught in the Middle, Hard Times, Forgiveness, Idol Worship. Like, I like those songs. And this is an okay album, and I like it. It's such a massive disappointment coming down from where we were with Paramore to where they are now. And now we see them playing small theaters. You know, they sold only, 56,000 copies first week. You know, they're
no
not going to win any Grammys.
No radio.
It's hype. Just watching a band dismantle their apparatus was so tragic that this album is just a big disappointment for me.
And knowing that it was 100% intentional, just, like, that's a stab to the heart, and now they're just twisting the knife. But another disappointment for me was Motionless in White. I know we have listeners that like this album. It just wasn't what it needed to be. And Roadrunner, it's just not getting the hype that it should have. It did 18,000 first week, coming down from, the 32,000 the album before that did. And
The Their sales were basically cut in half.
the singles didn't stick. We thought maybe Loud could get some momentum, and it got up to like 20 on rock radio, but it's so disappointing to see this band jump from Fearless Records to Roadrunner Records and be cut in half momentum wise.
And
That's
for those who
not
don't
what's
know,
supposed to
Roadrunner
happen.
Records is a major label. It's part of Warner Music Group. So the band had a much bigger injection of cash and resources into them, and they in theory should have succeeded, but they somehow sold half of what their last record did. This is, to me, this is the album that just it just wipes them off the fucking map. Like, they were this big
No one's
thing and
talking
now they're
about them.
gone. No one's talking about them. And Loud was cool. We thought it could maybe do something at rock radio, but it didn't. And the thing was, they didn't have any other rock radio singles on the album to follow up Loud, in case Loud failed. You just had a bunch of this kind of just middle of the road, Dark Manson inspired metalcore that just was, and they did kind of a cool thing with Eternally Yours. You got like some like late stage In Flames there. But there just wasn't enough. And it's like, they've got Necessary Evil on there, the total Melmar rip, which like what the fuck is even up with that? Why are you doing that? Like, I get that it's it's not Melmar's song, but like, she didn't have success with
Was
it.
her
It's like, oh,
hit,
now,
yeah.
yeah, it's like now we're gonna do it too a year later. Like, come on. It just, the album, and it's not a terrible album again. Like, it's something I could listen to in the car, but it just kind of blurs together,
Totally. And Necessary Evil, they sent it to rock radio. It can't get above number 30. And it's got the bro from Korn on it. Like, that should be, if you put that kind of effort into a song, it should be moving. It should get momentum. But the song sucks, That's the
They are,
problem.
and they already heard the fucking chorus on the Melmar song, so it's like, all right. So this is a big disappointment for me, but this is kind of interesting because this is our first time getting to talk about this album on the show. So this is kind of like our mini review here. Asking Alexandria, self-titled, The Return of Danny Warsnop, was a big disappointment for me, Tyler Sharp. How about you?
It definitely didn't live up to the hype, and that's the issue that I have with it. I think that there are absolutely redeemable moments on this album and moments that I can come back to and thoroughly enjoy, such as Under Denver and Eve in Room 138. But overall, these songs are kind of just as bad as what we got on From Death to Destiny. There's a lot of moments that are just not asking Alexandria caliber, the shit that we were used to on Stand Reckless and Relentless, when that band was kind of peaking on towards the middle and end of that cycle. We know that they're good songwriters, but I think these songs come down to the fact that when you compare it to The Black was a metalcore album with rock tendencies, and this album is a rock album with metalcore tendencies, and the formula doesn't work. For whatever reason, Matt Good's production is just shit. I can't think of a better word to describe it, but there's a sheen over this album that makes these songs sound inherently bad, and I kind of blame it on him because some of these songs are just so simple, it's hard to fuck it up, but they managed to do it. So
I'm right there with you as far as it kind of gets locked into From Death to Destiny for me. Like, I would just say, like, don't go buy this album. Like, seriously, like the first two singles, that was enough. That's all you needed. Like, I just like considering this was the moment that Danny was returning, like they really had to deliver and it had to be awesome. And you even saw me, I was hyped from the first single, I was like, okay, like if you're gonna do that radio rock thing, if you're gonna go do Five Finger Death Punch, like you gotta go do it and you gotta go all in. Or, if you're gonna come back and be heavy asking Alexandria, you gotta do it. You know what I mean? You gotta get heavy, you gotta get electronic, you gotta do it. Instead, we end up in this weird middle ground of rock and metalcore, soft metalcore or hard rock, which one is it? We don't know. Danny's just kind of all over the place vocally. And like you said, the production, it's hard for me to say because Matt Good is my guy, ride or die, but I don't know what happened. Maybe it was the mixing, I don't know. It's just things don't sound right. This one for me is like just right outside of our worst Scene albums of the year. Like this one, it could have been in there for me, but ultimately it's not because we had some real fucking shitters this year that helped keep it out of there. But
For sure.
so disappointed. Like for me, I'll take the black any day over this version of Asking Alexandria.
Oof.
There's nothing new here for me, or nothing exciting for me.
See, if I gotta rank my Asking Alexandria albums, it would be Reckless and Relentless, Stand Up and Scream, self-titled, The Black, then From Death to Destiny.
I would have to go Stand Up and Scream, Reckless and Relentless,
Ooh.
The Black, and then Tie for the Shitty. Like a little tie.
Fair enough.
I don't care. Like, I will Fair not enough. Listen to this one again. You know, I'll listen to the single. At least I'll listen to the single from this. I won't even listen to the single from Death to Destiny, any of the singles. That whole album is a write-off for
it's
me.
It's pretty rough. I'm surprised you put Stand Up and Scream over Reckless and Relentless. Reckless
you know,
is
man,
just
we did
such a peak, man.
It's a perfect album, I agree, but we went on those like
those
nostalgia dives lately, and I've just been listening to it a lot
more. You got a nostalgia
so
bias right now.
That's one that will shift, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Moments, yeah, but at the current moment, I'm just all about that sound, and
nice.
I wish we could go back in time to that, because wow, what a fun time. Okay, here we go. The five worst seen albums of 2017. So number five, Knuckle Puck Shapeshifter. This band, man, they just got bodied by all the other pop punk bands this year. Like, this is, to me, I think this is the worst pop punk album of the year. I think it's easy to say it, you know?
This was a disaster, and this is when they really needed to deliver. You know, they, for whatever reason, they actually had hype off Copacetic, and a lot of people still seem to love that album, but they failed hard here, and for a lot of different reasons, but mostly the fact that these songs aren't songs, and they're just horribly written, just horribly written, and I cannot believe that Rise agreed to put out this pile of shit.
You know, Rise just has a really fucking bad track record with pop punk bands, you know, like R.I.P. Polar Bear Club, R.I.P.
Mano.
Transit, R.I.P. Man Overboard, who am I forgetting? You know, like R.I.P. Knuckle Puck eventually. Like Rise just can't handle pop punk bands. Like, don't go to Rise if you're a pop punk band. You know, and they did what, 9,000 copies first week? So there's no real sales growth there for the band, right? I think Copacetic did something similar, right?
Like yeah, 8,000 to 9,000. I think it was in the eights, yeah.
And like you said, sonically, you know, just this sounds like an album made by amateurs. To me, this sounds like a local band.
This is your local pop punk band.
Yeah. I know local bands that sound better than this, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? This band, they just don't deserve the opportunity that they're getting. They're just, they don't practice enough. They're not masters of their instruments enough. You know, the opening track on this album just goes every which way. It just throws you, like, what? You know, you're just hit by this wall of sound. It's messy. It's sloppy instrumentation. It really just sounds like they didn't put in the effort, and that's what you know is just so hilarious to me about it. Like it bad mixing, stiff vocals. What were they trying to do here, man? I just, you know,
the name of that song says it all too, Nervous Passenger, because that's what I feel like listening to this
right.
album. I'm like so like, nervous of how bad this is gonna be, man.
Like,
how
what's
you're
going
like
on?
Well, it's never gonna get as bad as that moment. Oh my god, they just did that. That's what you feel when you're listening to this album.
you know,
like, remember when Gone came out, the lead single, and
yeah.
we were both like, this is a pile of shit, but maybe, you know,
maybe right?
there's something here. There's still
can't be
a
worse
whole
than,
album.
Can't be worse than this.
Oh, we were so wrong.
We were. Like, Gone is probably, you know, when you think about it, it's one of the more well-structured songs on this
and
album.
I just abhor that song, man.
Double Helix is, like, this example of, like, what it could have. It's, like, a good idea. That song is a good idea conceptually, but the execution of it is just fucking terrible. You know what I mean? It's like a local
yeah.
band covering a really good pop punk song.
That song was supposed to be their No Good Part 2, and they just fucking blew it, man.
They just fell the fuck apart on it. What you end up with, you know, is mostly just a wall of unpracticed and unrefound sound hitting you from every side, just hitting you, and there's just no real structure there. Terrible album. The best moment to me is that song Want Me Around, which is just them ripping off the main, ripping off Third Eye Blind.
Right.
So it's like not even, you can't even give them credit there. And it's like Plastic Brains, I think, which is the closing song. I mean, guys, like, what is going on there? That is just
no one
unbelievable
knows
how bad that song is. Like, when we said it can't get worse, like, that was the one where I heard, like, oh my god, they really did it. Like, they found out a way to be the worst pop punk band in the world.
It is crazy. It is crazy to think that this scrapes the barrel underneath up-and-coming pop punk bands like Grayscale and Rome and stuff like that. We actually semi-enjoyed music
from those before this year. They got bodied. Like, shouts to Seaway, shouts to Grayscale, shouts to Rome. Like, all these other smaller pop punk. Dude, Neck Deep. Like, this album makes the Neck Deep album, which we were disappointed by, sound like fucking Enemy of the State. You know what I mean? Like,
right? Yeah, put that on my list, man, if you're going to compare it to this.
They got bodied.
It was bad, and it was rough to watch. It was rough to watch. And now they're going on fucking headlining tours with no name indie bands. Like, shouts to Tiny Moving Parts, I guess.
Congrats. Gotta give them credit for how they handled the whole WithCon situation. So I mean, I give them credit for that.
I mean, they ended up canceling that whole tour. And they rebranded it, and then they canceled it like a week later.
Yeah.
They just announced like a spring tour or whatever, but they're headlining with these incredibly small bands. It makes me think that they just got turned down from bigger tours.
Any other thoughts on Shapeshifter, Tyler Sharp?
I don't think so. I think this band is on the nosedive.
Okay, let's move on to number four, The Used, The Canyon. So this album opens on a very dramatic spoken word from Bert that really just sort of sets the stage for how self-serious we're gonna go with this album, and that leads into the song For You, which I didn't realize until today is a complete rip of Jimmy Eat World's You Were Good from their album Damage.
I'm talking like note for note. Wow.
So that's where we start. Weird spoken word and a Jimmy Eat World rip. And it's kind of all downhill from there, isn't it?
This album is almost unlistenable entirely. Entirely. With the exception of the lead single Over and Over Again, which I understand. Shouts to their team for leading with that, because it is the only redeemable moment. And only 3 minutes of that song is redeemable. The fucking 2 minute interlude that just should not be in that song is almost ruins that song. But holy shit, Rise Up Lights. I can't believe, you know, I feel bad for the team because they had to release another single. And it's like, what the hell do you pick, man? And they picked that song.
And in a weird way, that is the only one they could pick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what else did they have?
I feel bad for it, man. So, oh my God.
And sort of the narrative around the album is very disturbing to me, because it's like this idea, like, if it's long, it's long and it's emotional and it's stripped down and it's a journey, so it must be an epic masterpiece. No. Like, in reality, it's 17 fucking songs. All bad. Like, this is, you know, this might not be the worst album on our list of the year, but it's, like, the most bad stuff. You know what I mean? Like, 17
because it
just
keeps
bad
songs.
Just quantity of bad. Yeah, like, this could be a double LP, you know? And like you said, Over and Over Again is the only good song in this album, and it doesn't belong on this album. Like,
no.
Shouts to Hopeless Records for somehow getting that song on there, because this is like, this must be like a throwaway from the last album or something. You know what I mean? Because it doesn't fit conceptually or sonically on this album at all. It's a good, like, Dance Gavin Dance light jammy kind of thing that's like really fun, catchy, and you just know Hopeless Records were like, look, if we're gonna distribute this for you, which is that's the deal they have, they distribute the Used albums. The Used are independent, even though they're not really independent, if you didn't know that. You know, the label was like, you gotta give us a single, and that's how we ended up here with. It's kind of like a fucking trick show that they led with it too, you know, because like, it just was like nothing like what we got from the album.
I think it's time to protest Ross Robinson, who produced this album, because Ross produced another album that is on our worst albums of 2017 list that we're going to talk about in a little bit. I don't understand how he okayed such piles of shit. These albums are, like I said, they're unlistenable. And it breaks my heart that these bands have fallen like this. And they push this as like this game-changing shit for their career.
This
how can
epic.
You push this? Yeah. And we said before we heard anything besides Over and Over Again that concept albums are bad. We have always said that. Anytime I work with a band, I'm like, please God, don't do a concept album. It never works, ever. And this is case in point. And
don't do 17 songs unless you're fucking Led Zeppelin. You know what I mean? Like, you just don't do a 17 song album. And what drives me nuts about this album, or I find fucking hilarious, is you can tell what they thought they were doing, you know, with this album. They thought they were making this grand epic. Like, you hear Rise Up Lights and it's like they're trying to like crescendo rock and roll history. Like, they think they're retelling the history of rock throughout this album, and the album is so ambitious, and it collapses beautifully and implodes like a fucking dying star under the sheer ambition they went for. You know, like, I'm convinced, like, if you listened to this album sped up, it would kill you. You know, like, if you condensed it into 30 seconds, it would kill you if you listened to it.
My best comparison I can have that I've been able to come up with for this album is Tenacious D's Scene album, gone horribly, horribly wrong. Oh my God, dude. I'm really at a loss for words, like I was the first time I heard this album front to back. First, I couldn't even get through it. I had to listen in two separate segments because I just couldn't. Yeah. I made it through 9 songs and I was like, nope, I got to save this for another time. But wow, hard to talk about this album, man.
Yeah, this was a tough one to get through. And, you know, there's a lot of emotional themes on it that you want to give Bert credit for. You know, he's talking about his friend who committed suicide and like his, I think it's pregnant girlfriend who died, maybe of an overdose. But like, it's all over the place. Then he even decides to dive into some revolutionary politics, because why the fuck not? You know, like, on this weird self-reflective Used album. Why? And, you know, the song, you know, Selfies in Aleppo. Like, oh my God, you are so clever, Bert. Let's like exploit such a tragic event for an ironic song title. And it's just like, what, he, like, you know, he thinks this is his fucking Deer Hunter, you know, like, or he thinks this is a Doors album, or it's like
Coheed
his big
Cambria.
Clint, yeah, or it's like his big Clint Eastwood fucking Western of an album. You know what I mean? And it's just, it's not. This was the most spectacular just failure. It was kind of glorious to watch.
Yeah. I'm glad this album's over, man. At least it got him to talk about Gerard Way. Is that the one saving grace we can have from the canyon?
Well, interesting. The sales drop. So it sold 11,000 copies first week. The album before that, Imaginary Enemy, did 17K. I thought 11K is pretty solid for this album. For an unlistenable album, you know?
Sure. To be fair, they dropped Over and Over Again and announced the album and put up pre-orders way before they ever dropped the second single. The second single
again,
was like
again,
shout, super...
Shouts to Hope. Right. Shouts to Mallory for just working with what she had to get some units.
I feel
moved.
For you.
You know what I mean?
As a fellow publicist, I feel for it.
They did, you know, they moved some units despite... It's like the greatest trick ever pulled. You know what I mean? Imagine fans who got this album, you know.
If fans could have heard the album before they bought it, this would have done like 2,000 first week.
Okay. On to number 3, Sleeping with Sirens, Gossip. Why don't you take this one away, T-Sharp?
I couldn't believe it. And if you listen to the... I wasn't able to comprehend how bad this album was.
I'm going to cut in real quick, Tyler. Tyler was so mad about this album that he was mad at me that I gave it a score. I think I gave it a 4 out of 10, and that wasn't low enough for Tyler. He was mad at me for giving it a 4 out of 10.
I think I gave it a 2, and I was genuinely pissed at you for giving it a 4. This album has no redeemable traits. And I could make an argument that it is the worst album of the 2010s, but it has some fierce competitors thanks to 2017. It makes me mad that we did an entire episode about them signing to Warner Brothers, revealing the Gossip aesthetic for this entire cycle, thinking that they could be the next MCR in their own vision. Because... the first 5 seconds of Legends just shows how this was gonna burn so hard straight into the ground. There was no fucking reason that this should ever been okay. I don't understand how scene bands signed to major labels, and then major labels, it's like they just don't do any homework and have no idea what the band's demographic is and what makes this band special. It's like when they got to Warner Brothers, Warner just automatically stripped them of their entire past, and the band had no objection to it. I mean, obviously, all of these bands just want to be superstars anyways, but there's something to your core demographic.
I think you're giving the band a little too much credit there, taking away the agency they had in this album. Like, I think, you know, I think they wanted to make this album, and they made a shitty album. You know, I don't think is all Warner's fault. You know, I think we've seen the band sort of lose it over the last few years as songwriters. You know, they're not the musicians they once were. And I gotta say, this album, it might not be number one, but I think it's the biggest overall failure of the year. When you think about the potential here, you know, Sleeping, pivoting off of Epitaph and signing to Warner Brothers and really having a shot, like you said, to be the next MCR, to be the next blow up band, and then to just come out and release a bad album that is executed so poorly. It's just the failure could not have been more complete. And it turns out to be a major label flop. It only sells 12,000 copies first week, you know, which you can bet your ass that's going to get them dropped from Warner Brothers. And that's down from, what, 35,000 copies for Madness?
Yep.
And that was on an indie label. You know what I mean? This is on a Warner Brothers distribution, major label, Olympic theme song, you know? And that's why, to me, it was just, it's like the biggest failure, you know? It's just such a... this album was like an easier listen to me than some of the other ones. And to me, it's just because it's such a light listen. It's kind of jokey to me. Whereas like going through that Used album was just like fucking crawling through the mud. This is just, I can kind of just breeze through this one. It doesn't make me angry. And like, you know, I like Legends and,
which you should be burned at the stake for.
I like Legends. I back it. And musically, there's just like, there's a couple of redeeming moments on this album for me. Like, Closer is kind of an interesting move into, like, an alt-country sound. One Man Army is kind of like late period Linkin Park. There's just a couple of moments I can appreciate. But, like, the rest of the album is just... a lot of it to me is it's Kellen's voice is the problem. He doesn't belong on this type of radio rock album. When you hear him on something like Empire to Ashes, which is just a 3 Days Grace rip, or you hear him on Cheers... Kellen, he just, this what, you know, Cock Rock and Kellen's
douchebag
voice.
Cock Rock, Imagine Dragons rip. That's what they tried to do.
It doesn't mix with Kellen's voice. He doesn't have the voice for it.
So you think if someone else sang on this album, it could redeem it? I think these songs are inherently bad.
I think it's a Cock Rock album. I think it's just insert Cock Rock singer here. But instead you have an emo boy on it.
But you think structurally these songs are redeemable?
Some of them.
Oh, dude, no. There is nothing redeemed. Yeah. Like, scrap it all. Everything back to the drawing board.
For me, the bad part of this album is a style of music mixed with a vocalist that just should never be mixed in a million years. It's just ugliness. It's like mixing... It's like wearing orange and green together. Like, what the hell are you doing?
I totally agree that Kellen does not belong in this world, but I think these songs, they tried a formula that really hasn't necessarily been done yet, and it just crashed and burned harder than anything that we heard in 2017 as far as like a major label venture. But real quick, I'm going to read you off a list here. Two assistant engineers worked on this album. Alex Howard, which is a guest on the album, worked on backing vocals, harmonies, and keys. They had another songwriter work on the album. They had another keyboardist that also worked on programming. They had two additional programmers. They had an additional engineer. They had a master. They had a mixer. They had a mix engineer who also did programming and was a recording engineer. And then they had a producer and another mixer. There were 12 additional people besides the band who worked on this pile of shit. What yeah. the? How does it go through that many channels, then get to Warner Brothers' desks, and everyone just says, green light, let's fucking roll?
Or more importantly, why the fuck did you have that many people involved in the first place? Like, make a fucking record, guys. You know?
I don't understand.
I just saw Sleeping trying to make a cock rock record, and it doesn't work.
I don't
they
understand.
They don't fit in that lane.
I don't know how this happened. And
it did, though.
It's a and, two. It's a two out of ten, Matt.
We come back. I still stand by my four.
You gotta go
stand by your
throat.
Two. It really is, though, the biggest failure, I think. I'm almost more disappointed in the failure aspect than the music, just because
it's just so
of
sad
the potential.
Yep.
Like, you blew the biggest shot ever. You signed a My Chemical Romance's label. You were supposed to carry the emo torch, guys, and you didn't. You did. Cheers. Congratulations.
Yeah, let's cheers
that douchey video.
Right? Somewhere, Jesse Lawson is still laughing his ass off since this album has been released. He was their main songwriter back when they were a good post-hardcore band. He was kind of their
yeah.
core.
What's he doing? Like solo country shit now?
He like covered Drake not too long ago, like Hotline Bling. I don't know what the hell that dude's doing, man. He's just kind of living life, I think. So props to him. He got out when it was good. He was sick of the Kellen show. I think we're all sick of the Kellen show.
Well, yeah, and Kellen has a publishing deal through Warner where he's going to be a songwriter. So as this band crashes, you'll probably just see Kellen start writing songs for pop stars and stuff like that. I think that's kind of Kellen's escape pod here.
It didn't matter to him if this album flopped or not, man. He's focusing on his backup plan. Now it's time for Nick Martin to focus on drugs. I'd like to have that conversation in 2018.
Flop of the year, probably, right?
Yes.
I can't think of a bigger flop.
Sure.
Let's go on to number two. This is the second worst seen album of the year. All time low, Last Young Renegades. So do you remember, Tyler, when I was a starry-eyed, naive young boy and I had first heard Dirty Laundry and I was fucking hype, man. Like, I love that song. I loved it. I'm not alone either. Like, All Time Low fans love that song. I see you all out there singing all the words to it. Except that song didn't work as a single, didn't go to radio, and then everything else we got after that was a succession of worse and worse and bad and badder and oh my god, you know, like the cheesy title track just fucking opening it, like, oh my god, what's going on there? You got like wannabe Springsteen 1975 ripoff Walk the Moon swirling mess of sad indie rock. And this was a tough one to revisit. I gotta be honest.
This is hard to listen to all the way through. This is a very tough listen.
I had to put this on my Spotify. Like, I had to play this.
It's rough, man.
It shouldn't be that hard to listen to a fucking all-time low album, but they figured a way out. How do you make, like, this should be the easiest, breeziest band to listen to. You know what I mean? It should be a light, easy listen. And somehow, I'm just like, how do I get through this? I feel like I'm in a swamp.
I will straight up admit that I was trying to convince myself that the Paris singles were good. I said right off the bat that this album, as soon as we heard Dirty Work or Dirty Laundry, I'm still doing it. I did it on that episode like five times. I called it Dirty Work. I couldn't be more disappointed in Blake Harnage. You ruined the Paris album and you did nothing to help this all-time low album. I say that because there are at least six or seven different producers on this album that helped write these songs. And like we beat to death when this album came out and we talked about it, this was All Time Low's second chance. Dirty Work was a failure, and it was their first chance to become the pop stars that they've always
wanted.
That
was their major label debut for Interscope Records.
And
big deal for the band at the time.
They fucking blew it. And if you compare that album to this album, it makes that album look incredible. Because this is fucking bad.
Dirty Work's fun. Like, there's a pulse to Dirty Work,
sure,
at least.
With the exception of I Feel Like Dancing. Thanks, Rivers Cuomo. But,
you know, I gotta be honest, I think I'll take that. I'll take that song over pretty much anything on this fucking record.
It's close. It's close. But this was their second chance. And if you talk to this band behind closed doors, all they want to be is pop stars. Just like you can trust Matt and I on this. We've seen this band in conference rooms. We've seen them this band backstage. We've seen how they act as people. They want to be the biggest band in the world, and they want to leave the scene behind. And they tried to do it on this album and failed epically.
And not in like a Paris leave the scene behind, go Pitchfork indie rock way. They just want to be stars. They just want to be famous. They don't care how they do it. These guys are, you know, they hired an agent. Like, they're just ready to take that next step. But for me, like, the tragedy of this album was the fact that there was such promise to it. You know, like, All Time Low were coming off a lot of success with Future Hearts. They signed to Fueled by Ramen, which, you know, that is the label that brought us Fall Out Boy. It brought us Paramore. You know, brought us Panic. The label that brought us all
the biggest
of
scene breakouts.
The biggest classic scene bands. And All Time Low have kind of always been in this weird middle space, right? Where, like, they're not quite as big as a Paramore or a Fall Out Boy. They're below that level, but they're bigger than a scene band. You know what I mean? They're bigger than you know, like Sleeping with Sirens. You know, they're in that middle layer between. So them signing to Fueled by Ramen seemed like their chance for All Time Low finally to make that jump up and become a bigger, more mainstream pop band. And we didn't get that, you know, and the promise to me, like, hearing Dirty Laundry, the thing about it is it's just a simple pop song. That's all it is. That's why so many people know the lyrics. All they really had to do was make simple pop songs. But instead, we, you know, get into this whole mix of this just sad rock crap and these chain smoker moments and like
wannabe.
The song Good Times brings you down. Like, when you listen to Good Times, it makes you fucking sad. What was the point?
I don't understand how any of this happened, because there was promise here. Like you said, they joined Fueled by Ramen. We found out Blake Harnage was going to be working on the album with them. We were thinking Dark Pop Kings.
Yeah, there was the proposition that Alex could be this kind of dark pop star. That was really exciting. You know, like, and the band were going to be there still, but, like, they could, you know, do a new thing. Because the All Time Low thing, let's face it, they had been doing it a long time. How long can you really do immature pop punk when you get into your mid to late 30s, you know?
Yeah, not everyone can be Blink 182. So, right. You know, when you broke down Dirty Laundry on that episode, it didn't change how I felt about the song, but it changed how I looked at the album moving forward, because I thought we were going to get more dark pop. And the way you broke down Alex's image in the music video made me think, okay, this is what they're doing. They're going full force into making Alex the focus of the entire band, turning him into the next Chainsmokers, bro. And instead, we got these bad pop rock songs that were semi-full band. It was Drugs and Candy is just the most terrible thing this band has ever done. And the Tegan and Sarah feature, like, why? Mm.
And if you're gonna get Tegan and Sarah, why miss so hard? You know what I mean? Like, do something cool. Like, and then you get a Nice to Know You with that embarrassingly upbeat chorus that doesn't fit on the song. It's just like, it makes you want to pull your hair out.
There's a moment that song, if you dissect it and take it apart and you maybe put that chorus in a completely different song, it could work. You know, it could be a good pop punk song.
If you literally surgically carve out that chorus and you leave nothing left behind of that chorus, there's something there. But that's the thing. It's that switch. You think you're going somewhere and they hop into that chorus and you're like, what are you doing, Alex? Where did this come from?
None of this made sense.
we were sad.
A mistake, man.
This is supposed to be a sad song. Good Times is supposed to be the happy song. What are you doing? Like, what? Get your shit together. You know, and it's the thing is, like, you know, what I liked about Dirty Laundry was that it actually explored an interesting theme about relationships and the past, and how letting go of someone's past can be a hard thing to do. You know, when you're with your significant other, oh, I know of all this terrible stuff you did, maybe, like, you know, I'm mad that you hooked up with so-and-so. You know, these sort of things, that song was about that, you know, getting over that, letting go of that, and seeing someone for how beautiful they are now and not letting their past define them. But instead, it's like the rest of the album, it's like, oh, poor Alex, he's sad that he's the life of the party, you know, for that song. Like, that's what
we have to
relate to him. You know what I mean? Like, poor you. Oh my God, you're famous and it sucks that everyone expects you to be the life of the party. Like, you know, like, how do we relate to that? Like, there were no real interesting emo themes explored on this album. And
that pisses us off so much because we know these four bros want to be the life of the party more than anything. You know, they want to be these pop stars. They want to be these people that everyone look to when they do something. And this was their second shot, and they fucking blew it. As much as I don't like these people as people, I wanted them to succeed. I want these scene bands to succeed. We genuinely do. But they fucking blew it.
We all wanted them to succeed. You can go back and listen to me fucking cheerleading. Like, I am the full cheerleading team when Dirty Laundry drop. And you can even hear Tyler Sharp, despite hating Dirty Laundry, still wanting this band to succeed. And you can hear us episode by episode just slowly wither down into fuck this band, man. You know what I mean? It just got to that point. All right. Number one, Tyler. The worst scene album of the year. Suicide Silence, self-titled.
I don't think I have the energy for this one, man.
not just the worst album of the year, but like I'd say the worst event of the year. Like this, to me, this self-titled, this wasn't just an album as much as it was a problematic event. You know, it wasn't a piece of music. It was a thing that happened. You know, it was a comet that hit the scene.
It was one of the worst things I've ever seen happen in the scene as far as a musical release goes. Like, can you think of another thing that created this much shockwave as far as how bad the music was? Nothing really comes to mind.
This might be the worst case of fan verse artist I've ever seen.
Like, when a band pivots their sound and it comes out this bad. I don't think we've ever seen anything like that. And as, you know, as we look back on this episode and at the end of the year and we've had, like, what, 8 months to digest this album, 10 months, whatever, as we got towards the end of the year, people just weren't talking about the albums anymore. They just weren't. We knew that they were bad, but people were indifferent and they weren't moving on. And I think that's the one saving grace about this album is that it was so bad, it forced people to talk about it. And that's the only thing I will say that I like about this event that took place. People were active because they were genuinely offended at how bad this music was. My thing is, their whole excuse was that they didn't want to do a quote bargain bin deathcore album anymore. That's fine. When you say your album is going to be 90% clean vocals, make it 90% clean vocals that are actually coherent and actually musically inclined. This album is genuinely bad music.
This is where
we get into that line of, art is subjective. Sure. But I think, as we've talked about on this podcast before, there is a line between genuinely good and genuinely bad music, regardless of preference, and this album falls in that bad category.
So I have an interesting relationship with this album and this band because, you know, I was a big Suicide Silence fan when I was younger. You know, like, I rode for The Cleansing, and I fucking loved Mitch. Fucking God bless the dead. Mm-hmm. Love you, Mitch. I mean, the dude just killed it at every performance. He killed it. As years went by, I kind of grew out of this band. Like, I was still a fan of them, you know, like I was all down for the comeback, you know, and You Can't Stop Me, but I just wasn't so, like, emotionally invested in them as a band. So when this happened, like, I hate this album, but I kind of love that it happened at the same time, because I think back to that first day when Doris dropped. There will just never be another day like that. And, you know, at the time, I was kind of backing the band because, well, first off, I hadn't heard the full record yet. And I loved the fact that they had contempt for their audience. I loved that the band, they weren't afraid to go tell their fans to go fuck themselves. And I loved that because I think musicians should do that more. When you have a vision, you should just do it and tell your fans to go fuck themselves. I loved that. But the thing was, the music kept getting worse as it came out. And, you know, they made a move also. You know, not only did I back what they were doing on an artist level, they made a move career-wise that I backed, in theory. Like, I transitioning away from deathcore to me was the right move for this band, because, you know, metalcore is over and deathcore is a thing of the past at this point now. You know, if metalcore is going down, deathcore is going down faster. And, you know, Suicide Silence, yeah, you know, they're the flagship band of deathcore, but it was the right time for them to make a move away from deathcore. They just did it wrong. And instead of them doing it correctly, we get the chorus in silence. Which is just one of the worst things I've ever heard. So, you know, it was interesting. I was backing the band artistically. I'm like, yeah, tell your fans to go fuck themselves. And I was backing their sort of career choice. Okay, good. Move away from deathcore. But they just executed terribly and they made terrible music. And that's kind of where I found myself. But looking back, it's like, it was just kind of fun to watch. You know, like, I really enjoyed talking about it with you on this podcast. And I really enjoyed just the scene, the togetherness of it, the eventness of it, just sort of the feeling that we were all going through it together. I really enjoy those moments. Kind of like we just had with the makeout song, the secret song that came out, you know, where everybody hated it, but at least we were all together hating something. At least the scene was existing in some way.
Right. It made it feel like the scene was still alive. Like there was a pulse here, you know?
We just had to melt one of our favorite bands down for it to happen.
Right. I guess that's what it comes down to. And yeah, it sucks, but I'm glad that there was a moment in 2017 where the scene was alive and people were talking about something, and even casual Suicide Silence fans who didn't even listen to the band, don't care, just know the name from seeing it on AP or whatever, were in revolt against this song. And I love that, the fact that the scene can still mobilize in some way.
They were in headlines, I mean, daily.
Daily.
They were the headline band. They were making headlines for everything, you know, just doubling down. And it got to the point where, like, I was supporting them being like, fuck their fans, but it got to the point where it went too far. Then they were just antagonizing their fans. Remember they had that weird just fucking meltdown on stage where they smashed all their instruments?
Yep.
And it was like, they were like little crybabies, and I had never seen a band go from being the heroes that they were, you know, coming off Mitch's
passing and making
You Can't Stop Me, to becoming just pure villains. They were villain, and part of me loved that a little too. I'm like, I like the villains, but it just, it went too far, and the music was too bad. And, you know, this album sold 4,650 copies first week, which is a crazy 69% drop from the first week sales of You Can't Stop Me, which did 15,000, which was their highest ever.
Oh my gosh. It's exhausting to talk about, because there was so much that went into this. It was a train wreck that the entire scene couldn't look away from. And like I said, in a way, I love that, because it mobilized the scene. It gave the scene something to care about, regardless of if they hated or loved it. It gave us something to care about. And for
that where
I guess I say thank you, Suicide Silence.
Is that where we are now with the scene, that if we're going to have a good scene moment, we have to chop the head off of one of our favorite bands?
I mean,
has it gotten that
do we have to sacrifice one to get the other to do something? Is that where we're at? I don't know.
I loved the April Fool's Metal Sucks article that they ran. The headline was Suicide Silence Issue Apology for Latest Album.
Oh my gosh.
We know we fucked up. I believed it for like 20 seconds, even though it was April Fool's, because it just seemed like something
that
needed to happen. Yeah,
right.
We know we fucked up. It was like everyone was waiting for that apology. Oh man,
I remember the first time I read that, and I literally breathed a sigh of relief. Like, okay, like, this nightmare is over. You know,
but nope. It didn't happen.
Nope.
And now the band are I don't even know what they're like. They're going back.
You want to know? You want to know what they did? Know? They did a 10-year tour for the cleansing this fall. Like,
they're
fuck
just not gonna. They're not going to admit they made a mistake and just go back to the old stuff. Okay, Ty, before we go, let's just end this on a positive note. Any surprises this year for you? Just what was a band who surprised you? You didn't expect that they put out a good record.
Sure. While She Sleeps. came out of fucking nowhere for me, man. This band has never done anything special. They've been shitty razor and tie metalcore band that never mattered. But they left the label, they crowdfunded a new album, they obviously took some songwriting classes, and they wrote one of the best metalcore albums of the year. I am very excited for this band, and
definitely.
I love that
and
album.
Just crush it with the Ollie feature on the lead single.
It's
going to be a classic. And it's huge, yeah, definitely. For me, Seaway. I think they probably made the best pop punk album of the year
I agree.
That was fun. Falling in Reverse also for both of us, I think. That was
hanging
just a
on,
surprise.
Man. Hanging on.
Hanging on. Sacrifice Me at Your Altar, Like a Lamb to the Slaughter, Slit My Throat Without Honor. Like, we really like that one. Another one I think we both are pretty hyped on is Nothing Nowhere.
Crazy, because we talked about that him on the show when we were talking about Lil Peep and how Nothing Nowhere was the only scene artist and he wasn't doing it right. Well, he dropped a full length and he started doing it right. And it's very exciting to watch. It is the New York Times number one album of the year.
New York Times in print. You can read it. The number one album of the year. Nothing Nowhere. Scenes, Lil Peep. I gotta say, just for the homies, I didn't like this album, but I gotta say The Main. Like, congrats just for all you homies who like The Main. It seemed like everybody who liked The Main had a really good Main year. Like, everybody was about that Main album. And I didn't like it personally, but I'm just giving you guys your shouts. Like, good on you. Good for you. Any other surprises for you, Tyler?
I will say, personally, Immure, big surprise. It's been Sharptone's still their only success, because Immure increased like maybe 1,000 or 2,000 first week sales. And they wrote an album that their core fan base would like. And it fucking rips. It's just dastardly heavy, and I love it. It's so pissed off.
All right, everyone, thank you so much for spending Christmas with us. Merry Christmas, everyone. Happy holidays, whatever the hell you celebrate. We are all about it. Thanks for spending your time with us. We hope maybe like we were able to give you an excuse to get away from your crazy freaking family and, you know, listen to some good scene music talk. If you like this show, please take the time to rate and review us on iTunes. Give us those 5 stars and we will love you. If you have any questions, send them to notescene@gmail.com. Otherwise, we will see you next week. Happy holidays, everyone.